Good afternoon to you. It's Thursday, it's 2:34 p.m., and it is time to head in the garden. We're about to join Master Gardener Ed Bajarski by telephone, but first we want to say thank you to the Flower Farm, and they're saying thank you right back to everybody in the community for giving each other flowers so often this season. And they are placing orders for trees and shrubs for next year, and they also are announcing that the Flower Farm itself is for sale. The Flower Farm is at 6 Rory's Road, Papke's Landing, 772-3464. And greetings and salutations to Ed Bajarski joining us by phone.
Good afternoon, Brent, and all the folks in Southeast Alaska from, L.A. South. Well, actually, I guess it's at L.A. Midtown is where we are today.
Oh, wow. So you're on a family visit down to a very hot and dry place, eh?
No doubt, yes. Next week we come home to appreciate the cool and moist and... the coolness, the moisture, and the terrific air quality, which is somewhat lacking down here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I hope it's a good visit, and I'm sure it'll be truly nice to be back in all of these conditions up here that we live in and sometimes take for granted. So it's always healthy to have a reminder of what we do have and why to cherish it here.
It is. I mean, it's good to get out. We've been very careful in our travels and wearing our masks and that sort of thing, and traveling through the airports on the jets through the airports and all has been honestly feeling safe to us. So, like I said, we're looking forward to getting back next week and getting serious about harvesting potatoes, and then that will be followed by garlic planting, of course.
Very nice. Okay, so it is that time of year. Maybe we should just kind of do a quick overview of what are the best practices? What should people do as they harvest? What should they do with the soil? What should they do with those potatoes?
Yeah, so once I get back, I will be choosing. I've got three different boxes of potatoes, and I'm going to be choosing. I mean, I know some that will be, they're scheduled basically because of the rotation of crops, that potatoes will come out, and then I'll do re-fertilizing to prepare for garlic. So those are likely to come out the first, and looking at them, I'll be very carefully digging with my digging fork. Hopefully I won't be spearing too many of the biggest and best of the potatoes, but that seems like it always happens. I mean, you can certainly hand dig them more carefully. If folks are not in such a hurry as I am to get my garlic in the ground, and if the potato plants are still nice and green and healthy, really, you can just go out there and kind of gradually harvest for, a few meals at a time and leave the rest of them there. The other thing that can be done, even if they are still green and still folks want to say, okay, it's time I want to get done with this gardening stuff, is to cut off the foliage, cut off the stems at ground level, and throw a tarp over them for a week, which will allow the potatoes to start curing in the ground while the dryer, trying not to have it too wet, depending on whatever our forecast happens to be. We can keep it drier is helpful. Otherwise, we'll get them dig them up out of the ground. I use various crates and trays to put them into, and then I do a quick washing of them before I take the worst of the soil off it, and then I can see if I've got much scab on some potatoes. Some varieties have more or less than others. It will also depend which garden boxes they were grown in. If there have been potatoes in the past there 2, 3, 4 years ago. So I'll try to sort out those scabby ones, any damaged potatoes, cracked potatoes, any of that sort of thing. Set those aside to be eaten first. and to then cure more carefully, handle and cure, the nice potatoes that look good, from which I will be choosing the best, the cleanest, the certain sizes. I may want larger ones for baking versus smaller ones for boiling. But I'll be doing some grading at that time, too, and sorting. So that's worthwhile. And knowing, and if I'm going to be saving some potatoes for seed, again, that's a good time to be choosing. If, as we're working our way down the rows of the potatoes in the boxes or beds, to choose some of those nice size ones that might be ping pong ball size or the size of a hen's egg, that I'll set aside, that I'll save those, and making sure they don't have scab on them or other problems, and set them aside to be some of my own seed potatoes for next year.
Gotcha. Okay, so those are the two main things you're looking for when picking out the next season's seed potatoes, is you're looking for clean and healthy as far as surface disease like scab, and then just the size, ping pong, you said?
Yeah, and again, sometimes we find there are certain varieties that are more prone to smaller potatoes, or some to a more mixture of small and medium and large potatoes. And some just seems like they all have, there's nothing but large potatoes there. So, I mean, we may not have that choice to choose this, just the little ones only for seed. But they can be still, if they're the really nice choice ones, maybe you want to choose the very biggest ones, knowing that, of course, next have to be cut into pieces with eyes on them for replanting. So, again, we should be doing our careful high grading of the potatoes for long-term storage, whether it be for eating or for seed, versus those that need to be eaten soon. Again, the scabby potatoes, because of those scabs, which are breaks in the skin, they will dry out more easily. So they won't store, they'll dry out and they'll wrinkle. They're perfectly safe to eat. We just peel off the scabby skin on them, no problem there, for boiled potatoes or roasted or whatever you want to use them for. But then the other thing is looking at our curing process, just like earlier we were talking about curing garlic. Well, we want to cure potatoes somewhat similarly. We need to dry out and toughen up the skins of those potatoes. One of the things that also happens, at least during, and it's normally in, we want to keep them dark. So whether we lay them out on the floor of our garage, or we don't have so many up on some tables or racks that we can dry them on, put some newspaper or cardboard or old sheets or something over them, to keep them dark if they are, if you're going to be using your garage or shop or wherever you're doing this to cure them. And ideally 60 degrees or warmer for the curing. Again, all that helps to toughen the skins, which again helps slow their drying out and will promote longer keeping in storage.
So do you lay them flat, like one single layer? Is that an essential part of drying or curing them?
Well, close to that. I mean, sometimes I'll do them, especially I've got these big, they'll hold about 30 to 50 pounds of potatoes in a crate. They might be two or three deep. But again, I'll have, first of all, like I said, I hose them down, knock the most of the soil off them. And they can stay in those crates if I have enough space. And maybe I will spread them out on cardboard or something on the floor. Otherwise, in the crates is fine, and even stacking them up in crates is okay, with air circulation. You might even, I don't usually have to use a fan for extra air circulation, but commercially that's done. I mean, they have big root cellars where they can apply some heat for the curing process, but also circulate that air in there to help pull some of that moisture out. So that's worthwhile during this curing process.
Makes sense. Yeah, you can picture it as a big operation, and that would get it done, huh?
The other thing, too, to be thinking about when you are choosing your potatoes for storage and which ones to eat first is that some of the earlier harvesting, some potatoes, there's early, mid-season, and late varieties if you look in the catalogs. And usually the early season potatoes tend not to last as long in storage as the late season potatoes or longer season potatoes. Now, you may very well be able to. Those early season, if you planted several varieties, you may notice that that some varieties have already died down, turned yellow, you know, the vines have died off, whereas some of the other ones are still perfectly green. So again, you can selectively harvest, planning for, you know, which ones you will eat first or not. But also, if you want to save some of those early varieties, then at some point late winter, mid to late winter perhaps, if you're pulling stuff out of my root cellar, which I have, luckily, some of those may have to go into my spare garage refrigerator so that I can save them for replanting later, because they will want to sprout more quickly than the later varieties.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, so that kind of raises one detail in my mind, which is, so folks are curing the potatoes at a fairly warm temperature to help them dry out, but then we're not storing them at a warm temperature. They want to store at a cool, like root cellar or even a refrigerator temperature, right?
Exactly. So for potatoes, and this would apply to carrots and beets, the root crops also, you know, you would, yes, those you want to store. I mean, we aren't growing, I know a couple folks trying, but we aren't growing sweet potatoes or yams. Those do or should be stored at warmer temperature, along with garlic should be stored at warmer temperature. But the other root crops, like potatoes, carrots, beets, should be stored as cool as possible, right above freezing. So again, finding that storage space can be a challenge if you don't have a dedicated root cellar, or you don't have a spare refrigerator that you can put them into to keep them in. And so again, it's a balancing act, whether that maybe it's the outside corner of your garage, or for those, you know, there's not a lot of people who have basements, but you know, basement is great if you've got a cool basement or a cool corner, an outside corner, that maybe that's a place to even build some sort of a cool storage closet, storage area of something like that, with a little bit of even having a little extra ventilation, that you might have a ventilation pipe going to the outside. You want to screen it so we don't get critters like mice and moles and rats inside there that'll cheerfully eat your potato.
Yeah.
But so you can actually pull some cooler outside air in to cool that storage closet, whatever that happens to be, that storage space. And, you know, if you know that you need to cool it down, you bring in, you know, you can get these small inline fans that will fit inside a piece of stovepipe, inside a piece of ductwork that come in like 4-inch and 6-inch and 8-inch fans. So again, that can be in that intake from the outside, actually pulling air, blowing air in from the outside, pulling it through those pipes and piping it down like to the floor of the storage space, bringing that cool air in. And then you might have, still, kind of like in greenhouses truly also, you might have a high vent out of which then the warmer air up at the top then can be pushed out.
Yeah, right, makes sense. A good flow that way.
You know, so again, that's something, and again, you might think about that if you know folks, maybe in your neighborhood, just friends or otherwise, who have other people. I've got space in my root cellar. It's 4 feet by 8 feet. It's underneath the stairs, which go from the first floor to the second floor of my garage building. So I deliberately built it that way, and I have space there. So I share some of that space with other folks because I don't fill them with potatoes every year. So I've got room so folks can bring some potatoes over, whether they want them for eating or for their own personal seed storage, which is fine. And in that same space, I'll put some of my fuchsia plants will go in there, and other different kinds of plants I can have buckets or barrels, tubs that have damp sawdust in which the beets and carrots can be stored, I usually, when I pull very late, again, just before freeze up, that also into that storage space will go a bucket with holes in the bottom of leek plants. And I dig up the leeks carefully, leaving soil on the roots of them, and put them into the bucket just like that. And then very occasionally we'll give them a little bit of moisture during the winter, along with that damp sand or sawdust-filled tubs or bins where the beets and the carrots are too, so they don't dry out too much.
Mm. You just kind of mist them, or do you mist those roots on the leeks, or what do you do?
So the roots, yeah, the roots, I mean, the roots are basically buried. So there'll be, I mean, these are, you know, nice big leeks in a 5 gallon bucket. I'll kind of pack them in pretty much. So I'll actually pour some water in there with a hose. I've got a hose outlet right there. That's where my water line comes into my garage. So it's convenient for that. And again, for giving my fuchsia plants a little bit of water in the wintertime, they'll get some of that. And I also, so in this root cellar on the floor of it, so it's built down low. And I have bits of water with lids on them. So that is also kind of coolness or heat storage, so they, it doesn't, the temperature doesn't vary too much, upon which my boxes of potatoes are then set. Mm-hmm. And those boxes, normally I'll put, sort of, when I sort my potatoes, I'll have paper grocery bags that I put potatoes in, labeled with variety, and then they go into the box and into the cool storage in my root cellar. So that way then the paper bags will breathe a little bit. The cardboard boxes will breathe a little bit. I don't want them in plastic bags in there because they have to breathe. They are alive. They are breathing. They are respiring. So because if you put a, you know, put them in a bucket with a lid on them, and this certainly will happen with carrots and beets too, they will rot. In there, they will, well, basically they will die and they will rot. Bacteria and fungus will grow on them and stuff. So if they have the air circulation at least a little bit, then they can breathe, and hopefully they won't, eventually I have to then check them later on in, you know, February, March, April for sprouting, when they have figured out, they have counted down the days and they know, well, it's time for us to start to sprout, think about growing again.
Uh-huh. Okay. And one other thought about storing there, as far as storing the potatoes, so you said you'll store them in paper bags, so I guess that kind of maybe answers the question of, we certainly want to cure potatoes in the dark. Is it also very important to store them in the dark?
Yes. And again, a big part of the reason, one of the other reasons, I mean, partly to stop them from getting this, the light that might stimulate growth, is also, though, like we want to keep, you know, when we were talking about hilling potatoes during this spring and summertime, we want to hill them so we put out more side shoots to grow more potatoes, but also to keep the light off of the potato skins, which can cause the greening of potatoes, which causes or results in bitterness and very low, you know, very low, I suppose, cyanide levels of those, which we don't want. So, I mean, we want to peel off the green skins before we cook them. Mm-hmm. Now, if you, this is going back to our harvesting time, if when we are sorting our potatoes and we have some green potatoes, but they have some green skins on them, but they otherwise are smooth skinned and nice looking potatoes, saving those, setting them aside for storage for the seed potatoes is perfectly fine.
Ah, good. Okay, so if a potato does catch a little bit of light for too long and starts going green, it doesn't lose any of its ability to be a good seed potato.
Correct. All the genetic potential is there, and growth is there. The carbohydrates, which is what they will need to grow, are there. They have them stored. So that's really what it's all about. And again, if you don't want those potatoes, if the green ones have some other damage on them, set them aside, and again, that can be just peel it thick so that you remove that green part, which does go down somewhat into the flesh of the potato. So right. You get rid of that. You don't want, I mean, you don't like, you can taste the difference. I mean, if you have ever eaten raw potatoes, certainly you can very definitely taste, if you just take a slice of potatoes, it's interesting the differences between the different kinds, not just in cooked potatoes, but in the raw potatoes too. Very definite different flavors there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Nice. Say, we've got a caller on the line here. I'm going to pull him up there on line one. Caller, hello, you're on with Ed Bajarski.
Hey, Oren, Ed, it's Sue Erickson calling. I got a quick question that I've been meaning to call and ask for weeks, but I've been in and out of town here. Ed, have I missed the moment to prune my rhodi or hydrangeas for this season?
Not necessarily. However, I mean, for rhodies particularly, if all of the buds that will give flowers next year have been formed on them, and you should be able to see them, the big, the fatter buds on the rhodies or azaleas too. So if you prune this time of year, you're likely to be pruning off some of those. We're kind of tail end of pruning for now, and part of the reason is for anything other than conifers, spruce trees, hemlock trees, pine trees, even cedars. Those trees, they seal themselves up really quickly with pitch. No problem there. But with other deciduous trees, and we're going to even throw in the rhododendrons with them, because they're not actively growing this time of year, you know, they're going dormant. They aren't really going to be healing over the cut surfaces of the pruning wounds that we may have on them. So again, for most of those, we're really, at this point, better off waiting. Unless there's damaged branches, certainly remove those. If there's broken branches, remove them. If there's dead branches, dead twigs and branches, remove those. Those aren't going to benefit the tree or the shrub at all. Otherwise, I would say wait until springtime now. And you mentioned, did you mean hydrangeas or azaleas?
I meant hydrangeas, actually.
Okay, so again, those are a little different. You know, with hydrangeas, I mean, mine are still, well, they're still blooming. And so those, I would wait for those to, at least to deadhead them at some point here in the near future. At least clip that stuff off of those. And if they're too large that you want to reduce their size, then of course then they'll be sprouted again. I would say most of that, again, would be better off wait until March or April when we start getting winter is hopefully winding down, and then the plants are starting to wake up again. So we're in the late dormant pruning stage.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Thank you so much. I knew you'd have the answer. Enjoy the sunshine.
Oh yeah, a little less heat would be helpful.
Okay, thank you so much for that call, Sue.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that's a really interesting tip there that I certainly did not know myself, which is, you know, you want to prune while the tree or shrub is still growing just enough so that it's able to heal over instead of stay injured all winter. Nice.
We normally aren't recommending painting any of the wounds with any tree paint or tar or other assorted materials, which might seal that. But again, part of the issue there with sealing it in is that you can seal in the bacteria and the fungal spores just as easily, unfortunately, because they are floating around all around us.
Right.
So, again, I would say just wait at this point, wait on the pruning until late winter.
Gotcha. And so then I had a call right before the show as well with a couple of little questions, two questions. One was, for the purpose of purchasing plants, some catalogs, they'll refer to a zone, like a kind of a climate zone,
yep.
And they have a number value. What zone are we in?
Oh, that's a good one. So the zone ratings are based on wintertime low temperatures. And there's certainly you can go online and just type in USDA either plant plant zones or growing zones or hardiness zones. So again, they refer to wintertime cold temperatures. They do not take into account summertime warm temperatures. So a place like Juneau, I mean, yeah, I mean, the, you know, say middle of the valley, Juneau, has warmer temperatures than Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Zone-wise, they're about the same. I mean, as far as growing and hardiness, Milwaukee can get down to 10 to 20 degrees below zero occasionally, less so than it used to. And Juneau, likewise, in the valley, again, is rarely getting down to minus 10 anymore, which used to get much colder. But Milwaukee in the summertime is regularly up in the 90s and 100% humidity and all that. We regularly get up into the 60s with 100% humidity. So you can grow more stuff in Milwaukee than you can here, something that will survive better. But to more specifically answer the question, so yeah, zone in Juneau varies in zones closer to the glacier, maybe as low as zone 4, particularly on the side of the houses that are closest to the glacier, where if we get down to downtown by the federal building, down by the Capitol, down in the low flats, that's a warmer area. That's fairly easily zone 6. Or places on the south side of Lena Point, which can be even pushing zone 7, because they also get the extra benefit of they're sheltered from the north winds, and so they don't get that cold stuff. They still get the southerly, you know, the southeasterly stuff, but that's normally warmer and wetter. So as we move south down to Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan is usually pushing zone 7, maybe warmer. You know, they rarely get to zero, if that. And they're usually, these zone ratings are like 0 to 10 below, 10 below to 20 below, 20 below to 30 below, and all that. I mean, even Fairbanks is rising. I mean, because of, you know, climate change, the zones, yes, still get an occasional 60 below, but pretty rarely. So when you're looking at catalogs, it may say not for anything below zone 5. But, I mean, I'm always trying. I'm experimenting. It's worth experimenting. And, again, because there are so many different microclimates in different parts of just Juneau alone, not to mention, I'm sure, Petersburg probably has a couple of different microclimates, you know, whether you're on the north side facing upward Lecanto Bay or Thomas Bay on that end versus down the channel. So you're going to be different in those different places depending on what kind of exposure you have. But experiment.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. That's great information. Lots to think about, but now easier to think about it with a little more knowledge in the mind. Thank you for that. And this same caller had a second question about fertilizing apple trees. He's got apple trees, and he's got some triple 16 fertilizer, and he's wondering when should he apply fertilizer to his apple trees?
Okay, so that kind of material, which is relatively quick-release fertilizer, granular fertilizer, that would be best put on around the tree, or actually punch holes, actually, you know, with a crowbar or a bulb planter around the trees, around the drip line of the trees. Once the ground thaws out in the spring, I'm going to say mid-April, say roughly, sometimes it's earlier. Again, that's when the roots are starting to wake up to start to grow so that they can actually take in some of the nutrients. And, of course, the roots, the food that's stored in the roots is going to be starting to go up the tree and the sap and all that. So timing, say, from early ground thawing up until perhaps mid to late May. And, you know, whether you help water the stuff in, or usually Mother Nature will take care of the watering for us, probably. We'll see how that works. So, but other things that you could be putting on now around the trees would be compost, because again, it's going to be slowly washed down in. Again, spreading compost out around the outer edges of the tree, out around the drip line. seaweed also, when we get seaweed pretty much from now into, well, all winter long, if we can get seaweed. And again, it's very beneficial. How much to use? So with the triple 16, there are recommendations on fertilizing fruit, on, well, fruit trees, deciduous trees, like so many pounds per inch of trunk diameter. So if you got an old apple tree, maybe 6 inches in diameter, 8 inches in diameter, then you, it might tell you you can use a total of 2 or 3 pounds of fertilizer, that kind. And but then you spread it out in holes, the holes that you dig, say with a crowbar or a bulb planter down about 6 inches deep. You know, it may be a quarter cup per hole, and to spread out your 3 pounds of fertilizer all the way around the tree. Something like that. Where with compost, you might be able to use for that same size tree, 3 or 4 or even 5 bags of good compost there, or, 10 buckets of seaweed as far as that goes, for all the trace minerals that they have.
Okay. That's that again. Great information. Love it. I'm sure that answers that question quite thoroughly for that caller. And then I do have one question, just maybe a super easy answer. This summer I grew nasturtiums myself for the first time, just happened to not have grown them before, and I was puttering around the garden a couple days ago, and the flowers had all turned to seeds for the most part, and they're these wonderful chickpea looking seeds. It looks like one per flower. I guess it's kind of fruited, I suppose.
Yep.
And so now I've got a whole jar full of these chickpea seeds. Not chickpea seeds, obviously, they're nasturtium seeds, but I should just plant those again next year, I reckon. But what do I need to do to keep those seeds in good shape to plant them again in the spring?
Okay, so if there's some that are really green, and it's worth checking the difference between green versus brown, more mature seeds. So if they're really green seeds, well, if they're really green seeds, you probably should be could have been pickling them earlier for your very own nasturtium capers to go with your smoked salmon or whatever else you use capers in or cooking. But they pickle well, but they need to be nice and green. So if you take a knife and go to slice through them, you'll see, or you've got a strong thumbnail, you can try to puncture the seed if it's a hard seed inside. There's a little bit of flesh, the green flesh on the outside, but gradually that turns brown. So the ones you want to store, you need to, let them dry out, put them out in a pie pan or on a cookie sheet, depending on how much you have of these, how big your jar is. You don't want to store them in a jar moist, otherwise they may very well just rot in the jar. So you've got to get them dried out. And then, again, next spring, you can do a pre-sprouting of them with some paper towels or, with a moist, literally a moist towel, cloth towel, too, and to pre-sprout to see which of these are viable seeds at that point. But the key really is getting them, choosing the most ripe ones and getting them dry.
Nice. Okay, so the super fresh ones, pickle those and eat them as capers, which is a delightful idea, and then let them dry and store them once they're fully dry, huh?
Yeah, and again, there's a design for that. A friend of mine gave me a small jar of them that we haven't gotten around to eating them yet. But so we don't use capers a whole lot, to be honest. But that's okay. We have some, and we need to try them.
Cool. Okay. Well, that's a great answer. Thank you so much. Well, I guess that's about our time for today. Why don't we leave it there, and we'll pick it up again next week, eh? Are you going to be back home by then?
Yes, coming home on Monday, so I think next week probably plan to talk about planting garlic, since one kind of follows the potato harvesting.
Okay, sure enough. Well, fantastic. Thank you very much for being with us, Ed, and we'll talk to you again next week. Next week is KFSK's Fall Member Drive, too, so it's always a super exciting week on the radio during Member Drive. But, we'll talk to you then.
All right.
Safe travels.
We'll see you then.
Okay.
Yep. I'm staying hydrated down here.
Okay. Yeah. Drink lots of water. All right. Thanks, Ed.
Yep. Bye.
Okay. There you go. A great episode of In the Garden. Thank you for calling in with your questions there, folks. And if your questions come up in the next week or so, feel free to either jot them down, send them by email to me, orin@kfsk.org, or call on in and we will get those questions answered by Ed Byarsky. Great information resource for gardeners in Southeast Alaska. And we want to say thank you to the Flower Farm. They're saying thank you right back to the community for giving each other's flowers so often this season. They've ordered trees and shrubs for next year. And they are also announcing that the Flower Farm itself is for sale. Flower Farm is at 6 Rory's Road, Papke's Landing, 772-3464. They're open 10 till 6 every day but Wednesday.